Hey, how are you? This is Dave Broadbeck. I'm gonna get technical doctor Dave Broadbeck, and I'm gonna tell you about, in the following lecture, Psychology 2606 or Biology 2606, whatever you prefer. Introduction to Behavioral Neuroscience for the winter 2024 term. Don't say 2024. Stop talking like that. You never said 1993. Of course, most of you weren't born yet, but we didn't. So anyway, right. So here's the lecture. Hope you enjoy it. If you don't really care, as long as you learn something. Okay, so today we're going to talk about language. We'll finish it up. We've got like two slides left. Then we're going to talk about thinking. And that's really our last topic. So we'll be able to get thinking done, I think, today. If not, we'll get it done on Tuesday. The other thing to keep in mind is that I'll have a quick sort of wrap everything up class where I explain to you what I think the big themes are, which will be very useful for the final essay question. Right? So pay attention to that, and so there'll be that, and then we can do Q&A. We can do that Tuesday, I think, because I think we'll have enough time, unless I keep talking now. And we will definitely have time on Thursday to do, again, final exam Q&A. So if you guys want to do that, I'm totally up for it. But that involves you having questions to ask me. That doesn't involve me preparing anything, my favorite kind of class. Because I don't have to actually do any work. So, if you are into that, well, I don't care if you're into it, that's what we're going to do, that's the plan. On that note, let's look where we were on language evolution. So, like I always say, previously on Psychology 2606, we talked about the evolution of language and the mother tongue hypothesis. I mentioned that. And I also, I think this is where we left off, the further we get away from Africa where humanity started, the less complicated languages get. So there's fewer phonemes, fewer sounds. So there's also less genetic diversity in humans. The most genetically diverse set of humans in the world are people who live in Africa. We're all much more the same. If we randomly select, okay, let's say we're just a sample. And we're a sample that looks like North Americans and then Asian people, right? That's pretty much what we got around here. Cool. And if we then went to Africa, then we selected, we have 20 people here, thank you for showing up, the 20 who are here. Because you'll probably do okay in the course. Bit of a hint there. But if we did the same thing, we went to a university in, I don't know, let's pick a country in Africa. Uganda, I don't know. And we went into a classroom and we took 20 people, way more genetically diverse than we are. Way more genetically diverse than we are. And languages are more complicated, more phonemes. And then you might say, huh? Language has a genetic basis? Wait for the next slide. And there's something really, of course it must. It must, we're hooked up to learn languages, humans, right? And I talked the other day about Nicaraguan sign languages, and if we don't learn one, we invent them. So it's pretty cool. Language probably showed up, this is a guess, between 100,000 and 50,000 years ago, when behavioral modernity shows up. Almost a yell. I could do some fake sign language, it would be really offensive. You remember that story about that guy doing that? At Nelson Mandela's funeral, there was a guy standing off to the side, looked like he was doing some kind of sign language, and people all over Twitter, deaf people, were like, he's just, that's gibberish.
I know.
Yeah, it's funny, but also really offensive and horrible.
Yeah,
you know, it's like,
that's what happened.
Yeah. Anyway. Sorry, we were just having our own class. So we figure it showed up then. Because human brains from 50,000, 100,000 years ago look just like ours.
If we took a human from 50,000 years ago and we cleaned him up, put him in some nice clothes, and he was sitting here, we would know he would look like any of us. We took one from 200,000 years ago, you'd probably go, okay, it looks a little rough. Right? But even if you took a Neanderthal, which aren't Homo sapiens, they're still humans, they're still the same species as us, and cleaned them up, they'd look pretty much normal to us. They'd look like, boy, that's a powerful looking person with red hair. They often have red hair, pretty sure. Also, by the way, you know Neanderthals, you know we're all frightened of Neanderthals, right? Because they're Except that, do you know that Neanderthals, first of all, sexual maturity around the age of 7, that's a little weird. It's fine for them, it worked for them. And, well, it didn't work that well, they aren't around anymore. And we know by the shape of their throats and the bone structure that they actually talk like this. So the scary, scary Neanderthal would go, hey, get back here! You're taking all my stuff! Or whatever. Of course, if he's coming at you with a club, you go, yes, sir, I'm giving you stuff. They were powerful guys. They also probably had language, by the way, Neanderthals. Probably. We can look at the, can't look at their brains, we can look at the brain case, you can look basically at any kind of indentations that are left on inside of skulls, and you can see that a Neanderthal brain had a very developed Broca's in this area. They probably spoke. They probably spoke. So language is a pretty new thing and a pretty damn cool thing that humans do. And as I said, it coincides with behavioral modernity. That's things like making lots of tools. So again, if you took somebody from 50,000 years ago, cleaned them up, and taught them how to speak a language that you speak, you wouldn't be able to tell. Because they're just humans. So there's a family in the United Kingdom who are rather famous, known as the K.E. family. Because that's what they call them, for anonymity purposes. About one third of the kids in this family have something called developmental verbia dyspraxia. They can't name objects, and really never learn to. So they have real trouble naming things, they have real trouble doing grammar. They can understand things. They can't really speak properly. And they just can't. You can't teach them. You can teach them what words mean, but you can't teach them, like, repeat after me doesn't work, is what I'm saying. They have less motor activity, as it says here, in the areas of their brain that control the tongue and their lips, their mouth. So there's something special about a gene that these folks don't have, and that gene is FOXP2 on chromosome 7. FOXP2 is incredibly important in all kinds of different situations for communication. There you go. So a lot of animal communication, bird song. It's not actually FOXP2, it's a homologous gene. Homologous genes in some insects seem to control odor trails and things like that. It's a communication gene. It also does all kinds of other things, by the way. Genes are like that. Sometimes they'll do, very often, in fact, they'll do one thing now and then one thing later. Okay. So with these folks, it's pretty clearly a problem with FOXP2, which is on chromosome 7. So there is a genetic basis. We see now that then this is basically just communication. Ours is just way more complicated than other animals. And again, if you want to learn more about animal communication, take animal cognition next year with me. That's a little commercial for my awesome class. It'll be fun. It'll be lots of fun. All right, some conclusions. Language is uniquely human. Okay, there are, yes, you can train a chimp to make some signs. It's not the same. It's not the same thing. When Coco, the gorilla, died maybe 8 years ago, There were all kinds of people. This is gorilla, New American Sign Language. And I'll tell you, and I was very happy to see this, that the deaf community were like, no, no it doesn't. It can make a set of the odd sign. Being able to make a sign does not mean you are speaking a language. It's a different thing. Those of us in the animal cognition community were all like, yeah, it didn't speak. Stop saying that person on CBS News. It didn't know how to use any language. It doesn't know how to use American Sign Language. Stop that. The thing is, they're almost impossible to have animal models here because a lot of times you have animal models that we use, right? Hard to do here. You can try, and you can do some things with, as I said, say signing with a chimp. I don't think that helps you nearly as much as looking at birdsong, frankly. I think birdsong is a lot closer. It's also something birds naturally do. Chimps don't sign until you teach them to sign. Who teaches them? People. Because we are awesome. Chimps suck. That's a really strange thing for me to say. I don't know why I said it. So, and like many characteristics, basically, as I mentioned throughout the course, basically every characteristic, languages evolve. Questions on language stuff? I mean, other things too, but best if you keep it with the class. All right. So, let us move on to not that, but to that. Let me start with the first slide. Whoops. This is thinking. We're going to end with thinking, which I put an exclamation point on. I don't know why. I'm really excited. I guess I'm really excited. Oh, by the way, I sent an email yesterday saying what chapters. Yeah, you got that right. Okay. I love animal cognition, it's my thing. If it weren't for chickadee memory, I wouldn't be standing here. And next Wednesday I'll be giving a talk about bird cognition in the speakeasy at some symposium thing I was asked to speak at. I don't know. I made up a talk. They asked me, I said, yeah, I can pull some things together. But I'm gonna do that, it's gonna be fun, so I'll let you know if you wanna come watch it. Point is, much as I think non-human cognition is awesome and interesting, and frankly, the experiments are harder to design because I can't just ask a chimp what it knows or a bird. I have to figure out a clever experiment. Humans are way more cognitively complex, though. There's a level of knowledge, of ability that non-humans have, don't have, that we just do have. We think about objects that aren't present. Now, I don't know that non-humans don't do this, and they probably do, but it's a hard thing to get evidence of. But I know you can. I want everyone right now to imagine that their bedroom. Done. Look, you just imagined an object that isn't present. It's easy. Right? So we do that pretty easily. We can think about abstract ideas, like justice, freedom, dignity, all those great things. I don't think when you see two moose, I don't know, two male moose headbutting each other in the lek breeding situation, I don't think one of them stops and looks at the other one and goes, why are we doing this, man? Like, that's not something, this doesn't seem right. You know, like, that doesn't happen. There's something special about us. We use symbolic and syntactic language, as I talked about, well, just recently, just 10 minutes ago. So, we're special. We also plan and string events together. Other animals do a lot of these things, just not at the level we do them at. We know that non-human animals plan things. I can't take the time to go through the kind of experiments to show this to you. Take my animal cognition class. Because you'd need a lot of background, and you're also going to need, it would take me 45 minutes to explain the experiment to you, so. But it's true. Just take it as yeah. Language, probably no, but they do communication. think abstract ideas, I'd be pretty surprised. I think objects not present, probably. Yeah, I'm probably pretty sure about that. I don't know that they can do it at the level, again, we do it at. So a lot of these things are matters of quantity, not quality. We have more of. But at some point, quantity becomes a quality all of its own. Right? It's like snakes. If you look at a snake, in some snakes, you can actually still see the little buds where they had legs. Do you say that a snake, well, it's just like us, it's got legs? No, you don't. You go, that's not the same as us. So what I'm saying is that eventually, if you have so much of something, that's like having a whole different thing. So quantity has a quality all of its own, which in fact is a quote from a Russian general in World War II, Gregory Zhukov, who, when he was explained to him after the war, the Americans said, look, we have all this great mine-clearing equipment, and they go through with these things, and they can hear where the mines are, and he said, well, we just send some third-line troops through fields, because Russia. And he said, it's free, the American guy's free, and he said, well, you know, quantity kind of has a quality all of its own. So a massive bunch of people coming at you, they're blowing up, but, you know. Little historical footnote there. Might be an apocryphal story, I'm not sure. All right. So we're talking about thoughts. So how are thoughts encoded in the brain? Okay, this is a neat experiment. So we got monkeys, and they're hooked up they're looking at a computer touch screen. Is it a touch screen? Well, not a bit, probably just a computer screen. And there are dots moving one way or the other. And I think this experiment's mentioned in the book. What the monkeys have to do is make a decision and say, okay, they're moving more to the left or more to the right. Well, if they make a correct choice, they push the right button, they get a little squirt of orange juice in their mouth. Okay, you can't pay monkeys. Well, sure you can. You pay them with orange juice. Like, it works just fine. This is a pretty easy task, and they're pretty good at it. So once it hits, 60-some-odd% of the dots moving one way rather than the other, they go, yeah, they're moving to the left. And they get orange juice. Yeah, let's do another trial. That's cool. But how does that work in the brain? Well, the thing is, these monkeys had single-cell recording devices, had EEG hooked up, they knew they were looking at V5 motion. And then we see we can tell when their nervous system, when their visual system detected that there was a shift either going left or right. And it happens 300 milliseconds before they respond left or right. And you might think, that's just lag, right? Like you think about playing a video game online or something, just a bit of lag. Oops, try that again. So, what's happening here, though, it's not just lag. And I know it's not just lag, because if I do a different kind of task, and not even with a monkey, let's do it with you, and I'll hook you up, you'll have an EEG on you, and I get to the right part of, I gotta detect, and find the right setup, and eventually I find an electrode that fires when you push a button. And I go, good. We got the right one. Now, here's your task. I'm going to show you like a clock, and it'll have a second hand only, and it'll sweep around once every 10 seconds. And when it gets here, up at the 12 o'clock position, right, your task is to push the button. This is, by the way, something that we would all find incredibly easy. This is not like this is complicated. And you can do it, of course. And guess what? You respond, you your motor system responds 300 milliseconds before your finger actually pushes the button. It's not just lag. Our brain is making decisions we are not aware of. Now, you probably knew that because your brain's also controlling that you're breathing. And you're not conscious, now you're all consciously aware of it because I just mentioned it. But you can go back to not caring about breathing. It just happens. It's involuntary to humans, which is really cool. And then involuntary, you just hold your breath, right? Or voluntary, right? But the thing is, this, what's called a P300, positive brainwave, 300 milliseconds before responding. Okay, it's called a P300. And this tells us that the brain is processing stuff well before we are aware of it. Because you think you're hitting this, that your brain is going right when it hits 12, you're doing it. And no, it's not. Your brain's like, it's gonna be there in 300 milliseconds, go down. That's really neat. And replicable over all kinds of tasks, all kinds of species. It seems like this is actually a property of nervous systems. So does that make sense, how that worked? The P300? Okay, because that's the kind of thing that shows up as a definition on final exams. I'm not saying it will, I'm saying it's a pretty good one. I've made up the final exam. Well, that's a lie. I've made up the final exam. Have I? Mostly. Yes, mostly. I didn't read the whole thing. So, that's a cool thing. Here's another cool thing. What about cell assemblies? You've heard about Donald Hebb before. And Hebb had this notion, remember the Hebb synapse? Well, Hebb also said, what about complicated ideas? How do we represent those? Well, the way we represent them, maybe, is patterns of activation of what he called cell assemblies. So a whole bunch of cells that are connected together, a bunch of neurons, obviously, that are connected together, and when all those neurons fire together, we call that, I don't know, maybe it's a thought, maybe it's a memory. So if you were to ask me how many goals did Rocket Richard score in his career, I'd say 544. No shit like that. Whenever I think about that, some pattern of activation, some cell assembly goes all together the same pattern of firing. This is Hebb's idea. It's probably true, like most things Donald Hebb said. The cool thing is he thought of these things in the 1940s, before we had MRIs or CAT scans or PET scans or EEGs, or, well, it's still not EEGs. Hebb was really smart. Also, Canadian, just saying. Do people try to be as loud as possible, is it? I don't like closing the door. They'll just stand here and yell really loudly that way, and then look at the hands. Okay. Or just go into that other room and start lecturing them. Oh, that's gold. I should do that. I can't. I'm so tempted to do it, but it's a real big move, isn't it?
Do it.
They're quiet. Now, maybe they heard me. Yeah, so. There used to be a piano a couple of years over years ago.
I was lecturing. It's down
the hall. Now it's there. Because one time somebody was playing, and I walked out and I just sat down beside them and started doing this. And the person said, what are you doing? I said, oh, do you find this really distracting when you're trying to play piano? He said, I teach you a class. Worked. Okay, the key to the whole thing is what we call the association cortex. So anything that isn't primary, like say primary visual cortex, primary auditory cortex, anything that doesn't seem to have a function labeled with it, we call the association cortex. Most of what your cortex is doing is putting stuff together. We're associating, the idea here is at least, that we're associating different thoughts, different ideas. So most of the cortex actually is that. Most, your whole frontal lobe, for example, Now, occipital, no. A lot of temporal, a lot of parietal, and all of frontal. Now, these areas receive input from the thalamus. This shouldn't surprise us. That's sensation. And they get information from, it gets information, of course, as you know, from primary sources, primary sensory and perceptual things. But most of what your brain is doing is putting stuff together. It does all the sensation, the movement, the perception, all that good stuff, but putting it all together and making and just being you is a pretty complicated job. Right? So most of your brain's doing that because it's a pretty complicated job. All right. Let's talk about something specific. The specific thing I want to talk about is spatial cognition.
Dave?
Yep.
Just for the monkey thoughts motion.
Yeah.
What did you say that was called?
P300. So positive 300 milliseconds. That's where it comes from. There are other ones like that. There's N400. You don't hear as much about it, but it's a thing as well. Yep. But P300 is the one that, especially when it's like when you're making a decision, it's all that's the, so that should tell you something more. When let's think who shoots a puck hard. Shea Weber, who's played for Montreal, shot a puck about 107 miles an hour. So that's about 170 kilometers an hour. A piece of frozen rubber coming at you at 170 kilometers an hour. Think about that for a second. Think about that, but you're paid well. Still. And that puck is traveling, and the distance to the blue line, the goal line, is about here to the wall. And if that thing's traveling that quickly, it gets here in less than 300 milliseconds, doesn't it? Because that's 3/10 of a second. I don't think you can shoot a puck so slow that it would take 3/10 of a second to get there. And I mean, even if somebody here has never even used a hockey stick and shot a puck. But goalies made saves. Watch an NHL hockey game. Goalies make saves.
Unless you're a Leaf.
You know.
And that's coming from a Leaf fan. Yeah,
always got a, haven't had a goaltender problem for a long time. And if you want to, if hockey isn't your culture, I don't know, looking around the room, how about cricket? People, bowlers bowl really fast. You guys still hit the damn ball. And again, how far apart is that? About here to the door. Somebody is throwing that ball, what, 100 odd kilometers an hour? Easy. Yet, no problem, yeah, I got that one. That's gone for six. Wait a second, how the hell? That means that the decision to do a complicated thing like sticking your glove up to make a glove save or using your cricket bat to hit a ball hard. And today's opening day of Major League Baseball. Hitting a baseball. 60 feet, 6 inches, that's what, 20 meters. A baseball leaves a fastball pitcher's hand at about 150 miles or kilometers an hour. And guys hit those balls hundreds of meters. And their brains decide when to swing before it leaves the pitcher's hand. Their brains decide where to put their hand to catch a puck before the guy hits the puck. That's mind-boggling. If you aren't completely blown away by how cool that is, I don't think you understand what the word cool means. Because that's pretty cool. When, think about this, when you're, if you've got a cat, when your cat jumps from one shelf to another, it's got to figure those calculations out before it jumps, but then it just jumps. I guess we're cool. Our ability to deal with things like jumping around, knowing where stuff is probably what landmark of consciousness is. Okay, how do I know that? Well, I don't know it, because I have a time machine. But I can look at our closest relatives. Primates like chimps, let's go with chimps. Chimps are like people, except they throw shit a lot more. And they also are a lot more violent. It's good that chimps don't know how to actually use real weapons. That's all I'm saying, because we'd be in real trouble. That's how you get the Planet of the Apes. Get your hands off me, you dirty ape! Okay, Charlton Heston, ladies and gentlemen. So, our ancestors lived in trees. So the chimps' ancestors, because that's our last, us and the chimps diverged about somewhere between 5 and 7 million years. If you take a chimp and you put a dot on its head, right? You just paint, like, well, just paint, and then you show it a mirror, the chimp will go like this, what the hell's this? What's this? You do that with a human, maybe, after about 2 or so, they do the same thing. They just look at it, what the hell? You ever see a baby with a mirror? It's great. Because when they're really small, they look behind the mirror and they're like, what the hell? And they hit about 2 and they go, oh, look at me, I have a mirror, you know. So a chimp knows because it sees the dot. We can do that with all kinds of other animals. Guess what? Gorillas don't. A gorilla sees a mirror, it goes, another gorilla doing things just like I am. You are mocking me. I don't know, I'm just assuming there's all kinds of plot there that's going to happen. Gorillas never lived in trees. We don't live in trees. Yeah, but when we used to live in trees, our ancestors, you know, it's a really important thing if you live and you jump in the trees, you jump tree to tree, knowing how far the tree is. Because if you screw that up, you're dead. But now we're on the ground. Remember when I talked to this early in the course about how we were on the ground now and we stood up and looked over the grass to go hunting. We don't, we have this complex system to know where we are in three-dimensional space, don't need it anymore. Oh, I know what we could use it for. Evolution takes advantage of that. And that's, this is the notion. And that's how we end up getting, quote, consciousness, self-awareness. This is an idea by Danny Pavanelli. So I should give him credit. Danny is a lot smarter than I am. Don't tell Danny I said that. But yeah, so Danny Pavanelli came up with this. Very clever. Okay. So the standing up and the big heart, as I mentioned. Put those two things together, we get maybe consciousness. We have specialized subsystems for dealing with different kinds of information. One of those different kinds of information is spatial information, where stuff is. Let's call them modules. Module is like a cognitive organ. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily have to correspond one-to-one with some sort of brain region. It could just be patterns of activation. Right? So, let's see if we have a spatial module. If humans have some, if we can isolate our spatial module without any other module being activated. So I'm going to tell you about some work I've done. This is old, this is actually literally 20 years old. But I'm pretty proud of this, so I'm going to talk about it. So this is some work I did with a couple of my students, Andrea Pike and Corey Spracklin, and there they are. You're about to hear a talk. This is literally the same talk I would give all slowed down and answer questions while I'm doing it, but this is like a talk I gave at the Conference of Comparative Cognition. Again, this is 20 years ago. Corey, if you look closely, is reading a paper called A Purely Geometric Module in Rat Spatial Representation by a friend of mine, Ken Chang. So, speaking of Ken Chang, he got the ball rolling and all this stuff in 1996. Actually, it's a Cocoa Puff, not a ball. You'll see why in a second. What he found was that rats would use geometric information to locate food in a rectangular arena. So imagine this table is like the arena. And it was about this size, actually. Yeah, it's not bad. And it's got sawdust on it, and it's got sides about 30 centimeters high on the side, and it's full of sawdust. And he buried, in one of the corners, he buried a Cocoa Puff. Because you may not know this, but rats cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Also, you know what rats like? They like sugar and chocolate. Guess where you find chocolate and sugar? Children's breakfast cereals. So, it's a real good treat for the rat. They love them, they dig them up quickly. Also, they can't smell them. They're buried enough in the sawdust that they don't smell them. Don't worry, this all gets controlled for. And what he found was that if you bear, they made errors, and the errors are what's interesting. So let's say you always put the food here, this corner. The errors are always over in this opposite corner here. Think about this. That means they're not using other information like about the walls of the thing. What they're using is short left, long right, because that's the same here. It's a reflection or a rotation. It's not the reflection error, because the reflection error would be here or over here. Does that make sense? It does?
Good.
Okay. So let me go through a bit of what Kent did. So what we have here is the dot shows the originally baited location, and then we have numbers showing where they search. So you see 71% here, but most of their errors are here, 21% there, and the different patterns and stuff on the walls of the arena. That's what those, that's meant to show. And then there's also different patterns in the corners. So rats use the geometry of the box. They don't use the colors of the walls. He even put peppermint oil in one corner. They don't use that smell at all. We have this idea that all non-humans do everything by smell, and they just don't. So this is interesting, but that's just rats. We're gonna talk about people. Well, let's fast forward a little bit. Talk about Hermann Spielke's work, where they tried the Chen task, but with humans. And they did it with toddlers and adults. Now, what they did is they picked these people into a room, and it was all white. And with the adults, you say the goal is over there. You just show it to them. Maybe, you know, with the kids, these are three-year-olds, you put a teddy bear in the corner. You say, go get the teddy bear. And then when they're done that, you disorient them. Now you disorient an adult, you put a blindfold on, you spin them around for 30 seconds. They take the blindfold off, and they're dizzy, and they don't have any time to be spun around, and they're in a completely uniform room, except that it's a rectangle. Great. Now you disorient the three-year-old, you talk to them for 20 seconds. Just talk to them. How are you? What did you have for lunch today? Well, you know, where's the finger? Easy. So sometimes they use the cue. So what they do, half the time they use the room was uniform. Half the time, the back wall was blue. Now, if the back wall is blue, let's see what happens here. Let's look at the all white section first. You see the rotation errors again. Rotation errors. Same thing that with Chang's rats. Toddlers, same thing. Even with the blue wall, no. Adults stop making mistakes. Because, of course you would. You'd go, left side, blue wall, done. Toddlers? No, they don't use the blue line at all. The blue wall at all. They still use the geometry, even though it's a really reliable cue. Just crazy. So toddlers in this case are not unlike rats. They are responding only to the geometry of the box, of the room. Adults follow the cue. Okay? And the same thing was found later on with Andrea Pike. Did an experiment where she did something similar. She had a piece of black cardboard, and she would say to people, the goal is here. And then she would take the thing and just spin it around. And while she was spinning around, she would distract people. The way she distracted people is she said, I would like you to count backwards out loud from 10,000 by 17s. It distracts you pretty easily. Because you go 10,000, 9,000, 980, I don't know where the dot is anymore. Like it's except for one guy. There was one guy in Andrew's experiment that didn't get distracted, and hey, some people can count backwards by 17s easily, I don't know. So what did I do, what did we do? We decided to rotate the object. So instead, kind of like what Andrea did with her piece of Bristol board, but in this case, it was on a computer screen. So subjects were shown a red dot on a black rectangle, and the rectangle was spun about the middle, okay? And the dot faded away as it spun, and The subject's task was to know where the dot was. So they would just take a mouse and click over here. So I can't write software that does this kind of stuff, but the person in computer science that I hired did. So they did that. That's just to give Ryan Warren credit. Here's what it looked like. So they are presented with this. See the red dot? This thing now spins at 480 revolutions per, is that right? Yeah, 480 revolutions per minute. I think that's right. It's very fast. So where was the dot? You can now see how hard this task actually is. This is not easy. So this, we call this the uncued dot. How do people do? Here's the original location, about 31% of the time. Oh look, they make in fact, they make more mistakes than correct answers, but most of their mistakes are rotational errors. That's good, we get to begin. What happens if we add a cue? Like the blue wall, like Hermer and Spelke did, so like that. Now it's easy, isn't it? It's not so easy, it turns out. People still make rotational errors. People ignore the blue stripe. It's moving so quickly, and the trials are coming right one after the other. It's not like you have time to sit there and think. One shot, what happened when I'm talking directly to you? That's really rare to stop doing it right now. It's rotating around, but people don't have, there's so many of them coming so quickly, so many trials, that I guess people didn't pay attention to the blue stripe. Well, whenever they can, people use geometry in this task, which is weird. Even if there's a reliable cue, I remember Hermer and Spelke found that with adults in a room, they would use the cue. We found with adults in this task, they don't use the cue. What if we make geometry useless? Well, the only way to make geometry useless is to make it a square. So we did, and of course, obviously, the square one's impossible. There's no reliable cue. You should get 25%, 25%, 25%, 25%, 25%, which is what we got. Right. Well, they follow, and of course, do they follow the cue when you put it on a square? Well, of course they do. Right? So what does this mean? First of all, any questions about the results here? Not about the interpretation of it, but any questions about the results? Does this follow? Does it make sense so far? Yeah, you're good? Okay. So this is a feature-independent geometric module. We have found evidence of this in adult humans, which is the first time anybody found this. People use cues if they're forced to. The only way we could force them to do it in this case was to make geometry useless. We are hooked up, predisposed to use geometry, which makes some sense. Geometric relationships among things don't change very much. Colors change. So, yes. That's just me explaining this. Yes. Okay, very good. So back to this. What does it mean? Clear evidence of a feature-independent geometric module in human spatial processing. Maybe if we slowed the rotation down, we would find people use the cue. And in fact, we did this, when I say we did this, Corey's going after runner's thesis. One of the things that Corey did is he spun it, during sort of pilot tests, he would get it to a point where people made mistakes, because you have to have mistakes. And he just kept making it spin faster and faster and faster until people started making mistakes. It's like, okay, good, now we can, because we need mistakes. This is one of those things where errors are the important thing you're measuring. So what are some things one could look at with this? Is it the case that, does length times width follow Weber's law? What do I mean by that? Well, if I get you to tell me which two things are heavier, and I give you two weights, and one of them weighs 100 grams, and one of them weighs 120 grams, you'd probably tell the difference. If I give you 1,000 grams and 1,020 grams, I guarantee you, you won't tell the difference. Because it's always a proportion. So if you do it at 120 and 100 is the only place you can find a difference, it would be then you be 1,200 and 1,000. So is it the case that people start to fall apart when it's a square? And do people always fall apart at the same place? Like at the same relationship, they say, okay, even though this is actually a rectangle, because I know objectively that this is 1.1 and this is 1, does it always work like that independent of size? I can tell you that that's other stuff that I've done, and the answer to that's actually yes. What if we put the dot in the center of the stimulus and they can't use the geometry? Not the center, but closer to this. Something else you can try? You can try with a touchscreen. People actually reaching out and doing it like on an iPad or something. Right? And what about pigeons? What about trying with non-humans? Hey, pecking at something. Now this was as I said, this was a talk given at a conference, and you always end your talks at conferences with your, I'd like to thank the following people. And the people I thanked here, you will recognize the one on the left. He's a young undergraduate, used to work as my research assistant. You recognize Dr. Keough?
Yeah.
That's him at 21. Or 22. He's working in my lab. That's Perry, another one of my students, on the day he got his rats. Look at how excited he is. And that's Matt, and he's a school teacher now. This was quite a while ago, as I said, it was 20 years ago. So my kids were quite a bit younger then. Some of you have met him, and she's got a PhD. And the talk was in Florida, and I lived in Corner Brook, Newfoundland, so I thought I'd show them some pictures of snow. That was my backyard, that's my front. You can't really see it too well, but there's a sign there that says Trans-Canada Highway. It's 7 feet off the ground. Look where the snow is. You guys have no idea what snow is. You have no idea what snow is. So that's one thing. So this is cool because, well, I think it's cool. My job, but I think it's cool because we were able to isolate some cognitive module without having to do anything with an MRI, without having to dig into someone's brain. So a few years later, when I was here, my student Stephanie Tannen, speaking of people with now PhDs, and I did this, we tried to look at lateralization. Does it matter if it's left or right part of your brain? So some of this you'll have seen before, so I'm going to skip those slides. And you've seen the one about the white room and spinning people around. And when I presented this at the conference, I called it a white room with black curtains by the station, and I could then tell who got the reference, because that's from a song from the 1960s. And then I said, and then they spin you right round, baby, right round. I can tell exactly how old people were by what music reference they were. So this is just talking about the red dot thing and those results. Now, here's what got Stephanie Tannen interested in this stuff, because what's Valor Tikara, God, I mispronounce his name all the time. And I felt so stupid because when I presented this, he was sitting right there. Then again, I don't speak Italian. I don't think it has anything to do with that, but that's my excuse. He's Italian. He did this with chicks. He covered one eye. How do you cover an eye of a chick? Well, you can take the chick and put your hand in front of it. That's not going to work very well. What you do is you take little pieces of felt, and you take false eyelash glue, and you just put it over their eye. The nice thing about it is it comes right off. So nobody gets hurt. You don't have to take the chick and go, well, I'm just going to have to take that eye right off. It's just a little thing that sticks on and it comes right off. So nobody gets hurt, everybody's happy. And you get kind of a badass looking little bird because he's got an eye patch. But he's kind of looking at you going, tweet, 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 arr. Right, so this is kind of cool. So what that does though, remember I told you about how with birds, the nerve corpus callosum, so right goes to left goes to right. And he tested them with both eyes covered, both eyes uncovered, etc. And he found that it was lateralized. He basically found that if you learn something in the left eye, it doesn't transfer to the right. And if you've used space for the left, doesn't matter, because if you uncover with the right, uncover the right eye now, they're still screwed, etc. So what he found basically was this was lateralized. And you can see here that with the right eye, we don't have the relationship on the with the rotation errors we do with the left eye. In other words, the right part of the brain is where the spatial module in the chicken is. These are chickens, baby chicks. Well, we thought, let's try that in people. So we wondered the following. What about humans? Human spatial tasks are lateralized. It's very slightly lateralized, but they are lateralized. So maybe there. So let's try the spinning rectangle task. So here's the spinning rectangle, as I talked about before. So the difference here is, instead of looking straight on, we either presented it way over, we had people focus straight ahead on a dot on the screen, and then we had over here on the monitor, over here on the monitor, the spinning rectangle. So now we know they're only using one visual field of the other. The dot faded, etc. Question is, where's the dot? You think he's using either a feature, used a yellow stripe this time, because Stephanie Tannen's brother, who wrote our software this time around, wanted to use yellow. So it's like, dude, you're writing a software for free, you can do whatever you like. Excellent. So we expected we would follow the feature more in the right visual fields to the left part of the brain, because it doesn't do as much spatial stuff. We think then, if you want to get statistical in this, we expect an interaction between viewing condition and feature presence or absence. And we didn't find that. When I gave this talk, I started it because the talk is our human spatial processing lateralized, and the first thing I said was, spoiler alert, no. It's not. There's no difference in the pattern of results. We also didn't get the error pattern we found earlier. What? That's actually bigger news here than I think than people think it is. I think it's really big news if we didn't find that, because it's a little bit weird. So the pattern of errors didn't change depending upon visual fields, so we can't say that it's lateralized. We're not birds. We have a corpus callosum. And while spatial tasks are lateralized in humans, the differences are very small between your hemispheres. And that all sounds great, but we also didn't find the pattern of errors we expected at all. This is, we figure, because of the speed of the rectangle. This was much slower, only 90 revolutions per minute, whereas the earlier one had 480 revolutions. It was just, we didn't have it rotating as fast. And I think I probably got a little bit guilty of thinking, this doesn't matter how fast it spins, just do it, it'll be awesome. I'm an amazing scientist. And it turns out I was wrong. I'm just a scientist, I'm amazing. We did find some sex differences, but the problem is, and you'd expect sex differences, that men following the geometry more than women. Wouldn't expect that. And that's what we found, except we only had 5 men and 17 women. One of the hardest things with the sex difference research at a university is the sex ratio is so biased towards women that it's hard to get enough guys in experiments a lot of times. So what are we going to do? Maybe make the task harder. By the way, all of these things are things you could do your honors thesis on with me. If you have an idea, just say it. Here's a weird question. When does a square become a rectangle? This is kind of like that Weber's law thing. Somebody did do this with me. And it turns out that it's different in everybody. So where you think a rectangle becomes a square is different from you, but it does follow Weber's law. It actually is always Within you, it's always 1.1, and within you, it's 1.2, and you, it's 1.08, etc. The ratio of lengths. So that's kind of cool. Is that being lateralized? We didn't play with that. All right, and then of course, again, because it's a talk, and then you can see how much older my kids are there. I had a picture of my wife because I love her. And they paid for me to go there. And this one, I just decided to thank them for the opportunities. I just thought, why not? And I thought, I'll show them some more snow, and this is Sault Ste. Marie snow. The best part of this is always people go, so did you Photoshop? It's like, no! Do you know where I live? I'm the guy who's, it's only 18 degrees out walking around in t-shirts and shorts because it's, to me, this is warm. Anyway, all right. So we have a spatial module, the upside of all this. So input from the spatial module or cell assemblies on top of cell assemblies of some sort come together in associative areas to make spatial decisions. And we found these things without doing any wet neuroscience. We didn't have to go inside anybody's brain. We didn't have to use an animal model where we were operating on rats or mice or whatever. We did this purely behaviorally. So part of what I'm telling you here is, part of this is me giving you a bit of a, just reminding you that you all behavioral neuroscience isn't just in petri dishes and looking inside of animals' heads. Some of it can be done purely behaviorally. Purely behavioral. So maybe the, oh, here's the thought. Maybe that's a thought. Because if I'm trying to think what thoughts are, maybe, oh, there's the dot. Maybe that's a single thought. I don't know. In the cortex, so that, you know, the wrinkly bits, in the cortex there are columns. They're individual bunches of cells that are connected between different layers, okay? And when these were first discovered, everybody went crazy. Oh, those are thoughts. That's how thoughts are encoded. They're in these different layers, and they're connected, and those are thoughts. I don't know. Maybe I'm overstating it. Point I'm making is that maybe these are thoughts. I'm not sure. I don't know if that's the either thought. I don't know. My conclusion of that is that maybe it might have something to do with it, is what I would say. But still, we put all of our sensory and memorial experiences together to form experiences. Think about, we talked about vision. I talked about how we detect shape separate from motion and color. And sometimes you also shape and motion, that's also its own thing. And it works the same with sound. The intensity, so how loud I am, is different than the timbre in my voice, the frequency, right? How high or low it is. And when I'm speaking, you hear words and you somehow know what these weird sounds coming out of my mouth mean. It just happens. Sometimes you have to go, what? Oh yeah, sure, because it's a word that you haven't heard, or it's like, oh, I don't know what he means, but I can figure out what that means because I know what this word means and this word means. But usually we don't have to, like if I'm having a conversation with you, you're not usually at a loss for words, right? All kinds of things are happening to you all the time. So right now, I'm swinging my legs back and forth, and then I hit that with my foot, and I thought, oh, I don't want to swing it that way because I don't want to make noise and distract myself, so I'm going to move them this way. And as I'm doing that, also I'm talking and thinking about what I'm going to say next, and also my blood sugar is being regulated, and also I just remembered the color of the August pane on the first calendar I ever owned was blue, and like, you can just do stuff like that, right? That all happens at once, and it's seamless. I don't know why I went with the calendar thing, but I do. Also, July's green. I don't know why I know those things. My dad gave me a calendar, I think, from the... I think my dad got insurance, they got a free calendar or something. So here, you can have it on 6. Oh, this is cool! I'm a weird kid! I was a very odd little boy. I used to read letters to the editor and yell about how people didn't understand the conflict in Vietnam. I was 5. I was the strangest 5-year-old kid. My parents must have been going, who is this? He's a weirdo. He's weird. I'm sure they thought that. Because, I mean, there are times when I look at my wife and go, and some of the kids say things, so I'm sure they did that with me. We put all this together, and how do we do that? Like, all these separate systems, doing everything from feeling how sweaty I am right there. I don't know why, but I'm really sweaty right there. It's got to rise in awareness or whatever. And I'm thinking about what to say next, and I got my mouth open like this and realizing, I look like an idiot. And it's a certain temperature in here, so I'm getting a little sweaty. I'm still not entirely sure if I'm going to take the hoodie off or leave it on for the rest of the lecture. Thinking what we're going to make for dinner tonight. I'm walking around. All this is happening all together. And I don't have to try to do any of this stuff. It just happens. This is sometimes called the binding problem or the hard problem of consciousness. I don't like that term as much as the binding problem. The binding problem is, how do we bind all these things together? This and the engram, that's how memories are actually stored, are probably the holy grails of psychology and neuroscience in general. If you can figure either of those things out, the Nobel people will call you. When they do, just mention my name. I would appreciate it when you win the Nobel Prize, if when you're up there and you're talking to the king of Sweden or Norway or the hell they come from, just look like, yo, just thought I'd mention Dave Broadbent. You can say anything you want about me. I don't care. Say I'm a bad person. I just want to be mentioned at a Nobel Prize ceremony. I know I'm never going to win one. But if what you did, I'll take all the credit. So how do we do this? I don't know. But the reason I like to end up talking about this is that this is really a bizarre question when you think about it, right? Like, this doesn't seem like something, it's not something you ever think about, but then when you think about it, you go, oh, wow, I don't know. How does that happen? And we don't know. This is what Aristotle called the common sense. Common sense means putting all the senses together. That's what it originally meant. This is something people have been thinking about since the people in Greece wore just togas and walked around, I don't know, speaking ancient Greek. Since they speak in Greek, but I think they still speak Greek in Greece, so I'm going to go with ancient. It's an old idea, and it's something someone will solve. And it would be pretty cool if it was one of you, but if not, oh well. But if it was one of you, I could take credit for it. Does anybody have any questions about this stuff today? It's a little philosophical to the end. All right, so on Tuesday, come with questions. I will have about a 15 or 20 minute wrap it all up, major themes thing. I'll talk a little bit about the final exam, and then we can do Q&A. All right? Got done a bit early, but I don't see anybody complaining as you're all wrapping your stuff up and not unhappy about that. So let's say we're done now. Thanks, everybody.
So thanks for listening to the lecture. I hope you got something out of it, as I noted in the intro. These are copyrighted, ShareAlike 3.0 Canada, some rights reserved. So you can redistribute this all you want, but if you redistribute it, you can't make any money off of it. And also, if you mash it up, I get to mash up your stuff. The vast majority of the music I found was on an old website called GarageBand, which doesn't exist anymore. And then it was called PodSafe Music. So this is all music that I have, that it's perfectly reasonable to, put on these podcasts. If you are interested, I can oftentimes find the name of the band. The name of the band will be listed in the post, and go look these bands up and buy their music, because if they're cool enough to let me use this, you should be cool enough to pay 99 cents or whatever to buy one of their songs. On that note, I will see you next time.